Welcome to In Season, where we explore the gardens and farms of the Lower Columbia Pacific region. I'm your host, Teresa Retzloff, and this week on In Season, we're going to be thinking about wildlife. We're in the midst of winter. There's not a lot that really you can do in your garden right now. The soil's too wet to dig. It's maybe a little too early to prune most plants. There's some cleanup you can do. You could be weeding. You could be tidying your compost pile. But this is a really good time to think about the structure of your garden and think about any changes or design plans that you want to make. And this is a really good time of year to plant native plants. And that got me thinking about native plants and their role that they play in providing food and shelter for the kinds of insects and birds that can really enhance our gardens and farms. There are several people that I know that I was excited to talk to this week that bring different voices to this conversation. And what are some of the things that you can do that might make your space that you control, whether it's a pot on a deck or, you know, 20 acres? What are some things that you could do to make your garden a more habitable place, a more welcoming place for wildlife? I first met Katie Volke years ago when she had just started as the land steward for North Coast Land Conservancy. She's now the Land Trust's executive director, and they have some really wonderful ways of thinking about wildlife habitat and the landscape and how the lands that they conserve relate to the gardens of the homes that surround them. Let's hear from Katie about how North Coast Land Conservancy thinks about the gardens that surround the natural lands that they conserve. I know North Coast Land Conservancy has some unique ideas and philosophy about how people's home gardens border conserved lands and how, you know, what's nature and what's not nature and maybe everything's nature. So talk a little bit about the philosophy that the Land Trust has about that.
Yeah, I'd be glad to. Especially, you know, our work that we do is really within communities. We're not way out in the Yellowstone wilderness or anything like that. We're right here on the Oregon coast, so we're in Gearheart or we're in the seaside. And especially when we were working on some projects that were up in the Clatsop Plains, so kind of the Gearheart going up to Warrenton area, we really were in people's backyards where our habitat conserved properties are. You can see, you know, somebody's deck and somebody's house and really the neighborhood. And so the conservation work that we were doing was right in the neighborhoods. And people would ask us a lot of questions, what are you doing? And we started to really figure out that we are not at all separate and that actually, you know, the work that we're doing on our land sometimes makes somebody's backyard even more exciting for them. And also that the same can happen where sometimes what someone's doing in their garden can really enhance our conserved lands. And so in that area, we started to understand what we meant by wildlife corridor and then also how everybody relates to it. It's not that it's something that's set aside over here that no one's interacting with. And so, you know, people started being interested in knowing, well, what kind of flowers can I plant in my yard that, you know, live out there? Or can I use native plants in my garden also? Or what's that you're doing, you know, when we're bringing in and planting big new shrubs and things like that. And so it started a really natural conversation with some of our neighbors and then got us excited about thinking about that where we do conservation work, there might be the boundary where our land is, but it's not the boundary of the benefit to the wildlife that uses the area.
Well, and, you know, so I've always loved the idea that, you know, wildlife, the birds and the insects, they don't know that, you know, over here is nature and then over here is a garden. To them, it's just all habitat.
Yeah.
You know, some of it's just more welcoming than others.
Yeah. A wildlife corridor isn't anything that we create. It's where the wildlife goes. And so, you know, if they're going through people's yards constantly, it's because that was their pathway. You know, they were here way longer than we've been here. And sometimes it's just the most direct pathway is where they go. And sometimes it's the most tasty food is where they go. And just depends on different seasonal needs and all that kind of stuff. And so, yeah, it's not going to be like, oh, wildlife, here's North Coast Land Conservancy's wildlife corridor. This is your home. And you wouldn't want to go other places. You know, they're always going to be going other places. And sometimes we really want to invite them to do that. You know, you can invite birds into your yard. You can invite bees and butterflies into your yard. And it can be a way that really helps out the whole population that's out here.
What would you say are some of your favorite plants, thinking about native plants, to incorporate into a garden that provide, you know, food or shelter or habitat somehow to insects or birds?
Well, my most favorite native plant is the red flowering currant. It has such a beautiful flower. I'm sure a lot of the listeners have seen it before, but it's one of those plants, too, where when it's in flower, there's almost hardly any vegetation on it. It's just beautiful pink blooms. And
it's an early bloomer, too, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It's like this first pop of color. Sometimes you see it driving on Highway 26. It'll just be kind of dripping out of the hillsides, this, you know, beautiful flowering plant. And it doesn't flower for all that long, but the hummingbirds love it. And maybe I'd go so far as to say that they need it because it is early. It's really bright flowers. It's really sweet nectar. And it's a great food source for them when they really need it. And they'll come in really close. I have a red flowering currant right in my yard. And even with my young rambunctious boys on the deck, I can still see the hummingbirds. They still want it that bad.
What do you think are some of the challenges that people face in trying to welcome wildlife into their gardens, or maybe not welcome wildlife into their gardens?
Yeah, right. Well, I think there's probably nobody out there that's really bummed about a butterfly coming into their garden. So that's wildlife. But maybe they're really bummed about the elk herd coming into their garden. And out here, that's a real reality. And so, you know, a lot of what we love about living on the coast is a part of that. It's the wildlife that's out here. And so it is something that we can consider, I think, in creating our own landscapes. And maybe in that circumstance, it's better to try to landscape for things that they just really don't want to eat. You know, if you keep trying for the rose and keep trying for the rose and keep trying for the rose and the elk's just going to eat it every single time, you can be mad at the elk the whole time, but they're not going anywhere. And so maybe there's a way that you can find something else that's, you know, equally beautiful.
Doug and Kirsten Ray live on a property along the Nequanicum River just outside of Seaside. And their garden is one of the best examples that I've seen of that wonderful combination of plants that provide food and beauty for people, but also provide food and beauty for wildlife and habitat for all of the creatures that they welcome into their garden. And I was fortunate to sit and talk with them about their philosophy and how they make their garden welcoming to the wildlife that they love to see. So Doug and Kirsten both join in. And how did you get started here, and what's your philosophy here about combining wildlife and people here in your garden?
Well, you started it with Packy when you guys came out and installed our first pollinator herb garden.
I remember that.
Raised beds, which are still the centerpiece of the garden. So, and that was the start of it. And then over the last 8 years since we've built the house out here, we've just been trying to expand on the garden and kind of taking the grow food, not lawns motto to putting it on the ground here in our, at least on the property we have.
Maybe describe how big your property is. How?
Well, it's 3.97 acres, but we only use less than an acre of it. The rest is devoted to nature. We've restored a lot of riparian habitat where now we can't really see the river from our house, but that's okay. You can still walk down it. We can hear it. And then the other two and a half acres are forested wetland, but that's our main core, you know, native habitat that we have for nature to use.
Maybe talk about some of the edible plants that you've incorporated into your landscape, because you have both fruit trees and bushes of berries and annual crops as well. So Maybe describe some of the ones you like, the things that do well here.
The cultivars or the wild?
Well, species? Both. Oh, I mean, okay. Maybe, you know, both.
We harvest a lot of red huckleberries mm-hmm. off of the property, a lot of evergreen blackberries, which are non-native but naturalized. And also then the last few years, because Kirsten has a really killer shortbread cake recipe, as I've been using more and more thimbleberries to use and to top those. And so we pick, and I go out and pick elsewhere, but as far as core native species, it's the thimbleberries and the red huckleberries and blackberries that we harvest from the property. Kirsten should weigh in about, she picks pretty much every day for a couple months. Wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I do.
But it's give the bird some, and then you pick a bowl, the birds eat some.
I put it in the freezer for the winter time so we can have it for breakfast.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that relationship? Because I know sometimes people get mad at the birds for coming in and eating things that they've planted for themselves. You know, how do you deal with that in your garden?
We share.
Yeah, that's it. It's a sharing economy. That's right. Kirsten, we just take an attitude of never stress, no bad karma to like yelling at the birds. Kirsten picks blueberries pretty much every day. The birds have the better instinct than we do of when they're exactly ripe. But as long as we're picking daily, then they get some and we get most. Yeah, I mean, I've been out there
there's
at least helping
enough.
Kirsten. Yeah, there's enough for everybody is the way we approach it. And they eat a lot of the berries. I mean, birds of cedar waxwings and the red robins. But when you're picking up, you know, in your garden blueberry patch and you have three or four cedar waxwings in the bush next to you whistling and gobbling berries, they're pretty good picking partners. There's a trade-off. Yeah, we don't mind it at all.
We were looking earlier at your stand of kale that's still pretty impressive this time of year. And you were talking about what happens when it starts to flower. What do you like about that?
Well, Kirsten saw it for the first time last year. Now we're going to really pay attention.
They color their flowers as the same as the goldfinches. So they're hard to tell apart. But the goldfinches go in and sit and eat the seeds from the
And the flowers.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
We let them go and they bolt, Teresa, and then they go to flower. But Kirsten told me to come out one day last early, kind of late spring, and I'm like, there's 15 goldfinches, but you couldn't see them because they're the exact same color as the blossoms on the kale bush. And they were just eating the flowers as fast as they could. And then as they went to seed over, you know, a couple of weeks, they flowered to seed. Then they came and ate those. But it was the first thing they got when they're coming from their migration to come back to our yard was our leftover kale plants that we, instead of, because I was going to dig them up eventually, but I'd let them, and they bolted. And we didn't know it, but goldfinches love kale flowers and seeds. And so we're like, woohoo! And they're the same exact beautiful color of yellow gold. So,
what are some of the things that you've done to make your garden welcoming to wildlife, do you think?
Well, the number one thing is we use no biocides ever on anything. The only thing we use is stale beer, or if I have to go buy it too, for slugs. And we don't do, I guess you would call it, we try and use it just a holistic organic. We don't want to do anything that would provide any impacts to any of the animals that use the garden. So I don't know, other than that we have kind of, you know, I use my kind of ecological experience for edge effect and the way we've planted the garden and where we put things and where the native shrubs are. I think it's important that the birds and any animals that come in the garden, you know, like brush rabbits, and which we're happy to have, and they come and eat too, but they never eat too much. They don't have far to go to be in the garden, to be back in the forest. It's a matter of just a few feet. And so it's kind of, I think that's an important consideration, that you can't have a garden and expect wildlife to use it if there's a big open space between where their normal habitat is and where the garden is. Now, most people probably don't want them to come up. We'd like to have them. That integration of providing, because the animals don't know it's our yard. They just think it's habitat. And they just have a few extra special things to get to eat once in a while, like kale flowers and strawberries and blueberries that are not normally available. And so I think that's the most important consideration from a habitat support perspective, is make it, if you're going to have them, you know, make it accessible.
Seeds.
Yeah.
So you also have bird feeders and you put out seed for birds as well.
Yeah, and as if you can see, Teresa, we actually plan where our raised beds are integrated into our songbird habitat where we have the feeders. So that's another element, I think, that where the way the approach we've taken is trying to not make a distinction between the garden and the habitat so much, but try and integrate it as best we can. That's one thing that just comes to mind is, like, this last few years I've been trying to grow pumpkins and sunflower seeds in a little special plot. And then this year that we had new neighbor kids next door, and they got to come over and pick out a pumpkin each. They were pretty excited. But then I leave all the balance, and within a couple weeks, all the pumpkins are consumed 100% by stellar jays, because it's the first thing they start working in the fall when they start aggregating from being in breeding pairs and territorial. And then right now when Kirsten goes out to feed, like this afternoon or in the morning, that'd be 40 or 50 stellar jays. But what I've been so stoked about is I have, you know, 20, 30, 40 surplus pumpkins spread out in the garden. And by Thanksgiving, there's not a single one. They eat them down to the stem, which is kind of cool. And you see them, they drill these holes and then get their heads in and eat all the seeds. It's you know.
It was almost like Christmas.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That maybe there was the last ones they got was around Christmas, when that's when they don't have anything else other than what Kirsten's feeding from the seeds. So,
what are some of the plants that you think, native plants, if you're thinking about native plants, that you could incorporate into the garden? What are the ones that you've had the most success with?
Elderberry is really good. Cascara. And again, I'm thinking of those because of their, not just their function for berries, for wildlife, but also for pollinators that are so important. You know, I have lots of cascara. Crabapple, which we've planted dozens of here, which hasn't gotten old enough to start.
The native crabapple,
are really important. But I would have to say, just from observation here in 8 years of living, is if you have thimbleberry and salmonberry, red huckleberry, you're really, if you can have those, or want to, if you want to have wildlife and benefit them along with your normal cultivars, those are the three core species that are all good for you, for us to eat, but the songbirds and small mammals, you know, squirrels and chipmunks, all, yeah. Just a side note, Teresa, the alpine evergreen strawberries that you did for our first raised bed.
Yeah.
The chipmunks, it is a annual summer tradition that the chipmunks come up and eat their strawberries on the deck here while we're sitting in here and watching them. They eat them around and around and round like you, I don't know how to describe
like
it.
Like a corn on the cob.
Like a corn on the cob until it's all gone. And the chipmunks, they use our outdoor kitchen deck as their dining area.
We're going to take a short break here to remind you that you're listening to Coast Community Radio, KMUN Astoria 91.9 FM, and KTCB Tillamook 89.5 FM. We're also streaming live at coastradio.org. And if you're just joining us, you're listening to In Season, where we explore the gardens and farms of the Lower Columbia Pacific region. Today, we're looking at wildlife and how to make our gardens and farms more welcoming to the birds and pollinating insects, bumblebees, butterflies, that enhance our lives, enhance our habitat, and make our gardens more beautiful. Mike Patterson is an ecological consultant and an avid birder, and one of the coolest guys I know to talk about wildlife. He has a encyclopedic memory for all kinds of plants and critters and birds and bees and moths, and knows a lot about what it takes to make your garden the kind of place that they want to hang out in. I was fortunate to talk with him recently, and he gave me some really great insight into how to think about your garden in a way that is going to create a welcoming space for wildlife.
My garden is in a little bit of a disarray right now, and probably doesn't reflect actually it does, because it's sort of, it's a free-form garden that does what it wants, not what we want it to do. We just let it go, and every once in a while we get the lawnmower out, or in the spring we'll plant some plants around. But we let the moles dig the mole holes, and we let the western scrub jays have the apples, and we basically just, we don't work very hard at being too controlling in the yard, and sometimes it looks a little worse for wear and tear and doesn't always meet the human standards for tidiness that some other people might want. But it does, I think, it does reflect my larger philosophy about yards as ecosystems and gardens as ecosystems. And an ecosystem is the interaction between the different organisms and the non-living parts of a system sort of going together. And so anytime you have living organisms...
Which we are.
interacting with other living organisms, you have an ecosystem. And so a garden is, in every possible way you could think of, an ecosystem. And all ecosystems have different organisms that influence that system, but almost all ecosystems also have one or two species, which are called keystone species. And those keystone species, their presence or absence completely changes how the ecosystem functions. And so in a garden, you're dealing with yourself as the keystone species. The person who is gardening is the keystone species. And if you take the gardener out, you get a yard that looks like mine. And if you put the gardener back in, you get a garden that looks like somebody else's garden. And depending on the control issues of that particular keystone species, the garden may look very, very nice with straight rows, or it might be a little more freeform. But all gardens are ecosystems.
But from the point of view of a bumblebee or a bird or a butterfly, I mean, your garden is still wildlife habitat. It may just be some may be more welcoming than others.
Well, all of them are welcoming in the sense that a bee does not say, I'm not going to go there because the lines of between the flowers are too straight. They're going to go there because of the flowers.
Yeah.
And that's the same. It doesn't matter whether it's a bee or a vole or a deer or an earthworm. They're going to be picking those habitats because they find something attractive about the habitat. And we shouldn't be surprised if they pick the things that we're trying to protect or keep for ourselves as something they find attractive, which is, as I said, I let the scrub jays have my apples, even though I take some of those apples and make applesauce or whatever out of them. I don't worry about the scrub jays also getting to eat some of the apples because it is impractical for me to try to come up with a way to keep the scrub jays from eating the apples, and I like the scrub jays anyway. So
you just have to make peace with it.
You have to make peace with it, and you have to find strategies that are going to let you live with the stuff that's around you, because any ecosystem is going to attract those organisms that find what's inside that. That's what ecosystems are about. They're about organisms interacting with one another, competing with each other, cooperating with each other, sharing with each other, not sharing with each other, eating each other. All of those things happen in an ecosystem, and you just have to live with it.
How do you feel about sort of bird feeders versus trying to plant plants that provide food for birds? I mean, do you think that it's both or either or?
There have been lots of studies done about bird feeders, mm-hmm. and the truth that most people who feed birds don't want to hear is that the birds don't need bird feeders. That when you're putting a bird feeder in your yard, it's not for the birds, it's for you. Now, that's not a bad thing, but the birds are going to do just fine without any bird feeders at all. So the bird feeder, when you put a bird feeder out there, you're putting a bird feeder out there for birds. And some squirrels are going to eat it. The deer are probably, we have the deer come in and stick. If I put sunflower seed in my bird feeder out here, the deer, you come out at night and the deer, there's four or five deer with their heads in their bird feeder. But if you plant plants, then you are diversifying your yard so that you're not just aiming at birds, you're aiming at all kinds of critters. And so if the better strategy, the better long-term strategy for inviting wildlife into your yard is to create habitat. And bird feeders are not habitat. They're feeding troughs. And what you really want, if you want to attract wildlife, is you want to have places where the birds can feel safe, so shrubby plants. You want to have the kind of plants which are going to produce pollen for insects. Insects, if you attract a pollinator to to your yard, they're going to pollinate everything.
Yeah.
They're also going to attract birds, because there are birds that don't come to bird feeders but come to insects that are in the trees. And so you actually get more birds in a yard that's got a diversified habitat, because it's got safe hiding places, places where they can go when it's rainy or icky. And there are different kinds of nectar sources for birds and insects to eat, seeds, fruit, all of those things are going to attract birds and other kinds of animals. And so there really is, it's an apples and oranges kind of thing between bird feeders and basically wildscaping your yard. But you can tell that I favor wildscaping over bird feeding.
How important is water, having a source of water in your garden?
The only time around here where you really need to put water out is when it's really cold and all the water is frozen over. Most people don't think about that. That's actually more important than finding water in the summertime around here. As far as flowers go, flowers is a little trickier, but you don't run into the problem with invasiveness with a lot of these flowers that you run into with other things. So a lot, you know, just about any kind of flower. Insects like yellow, and they
insects like yellow.
Insect like yellow,
and I've always found the bumblebees and honeybees that are around on our property, they're really attracted to kind of purpley blue flowers.
Well, there's also purple blue also, yes, but if you look
but the
at
yellow
a lot
is
of,
the most attractive.
Yeah, if you go out and you watch, if you look at most of the native plants around here,
mm-hmm.
They're variations on yellow. They might have a white disc. Or a blue disc, but there's that yellow center part. And if you put those under black light, it's really kind of cool, because the bees can actually see more colors than we can, and it's a target. You know, that's that big blue disc.
I've
and
heard
then
that
little,
under black light, it looks almost like a landing strip.
Yeah,
it's, here's the pollen.
Exactly.
Do you have any
and
plants
but things like
really
the native iris, Tenax, is a cool plant. I like Columbia lilies, and it's fun to get the butterflies. The butterflies will come and hang upside down on those Columbia lilies, and they're tiger lilies. But with insects, variety is better.
When you stand in your garden in the middle of summer and listen to the bees hum and the birds tweet, and you see butterflies flying around, it's such a wonderful sensation knowing that all of these creatures are moving through your landscape and helping to enhance your garden. Sometimes they're enhancing it by eating each other, and sometimes they're enhancing it by pollinating the flowers and the vegetables and fruits that you want to eat later in the season. And sometimes they're just beautiful, and they just make being outside in your garden a more wonderful experience. Things that you can do to make your garden a more welcoming place for wildlife are pretty simple. It's food and shelter and a welcome mat that says, hey, come on in. Thank you so much to this week's guests, Katie Volke from North Coast Land Conservancy, Doug and Kirsten Ray, and Mike Patterson. I really appreciate them sharing their insights and inspirations with us about welcoming wildlife to the garden. Thank you so much to our brilliant sound engineer, Katie Claiborne. And thank you for joining us on In Season. You can find us on the first and third Tuesdays of the month on Coast Community Radio, and we look forward to talking with you next time.